This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
All right, welcome back. We're here with Chris Vandio from Penn Lincoln Strategies, who's married to Maureen, a former producer at NBC Connecticut. It was NBC 30 back in the day, who I worked with for a couple of years. Great producer. She was a great TV producer.
She was. Probably still would be.
Yeah. She's not going to go back.
No.
No, God, no.
If you say that again, we're going to see her pop up in the window over there.
Yeah, she always seemed too well adjusted for that life, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I mean,
you got to be a little different to do it all for a full career.
And the hours were nuts, right?
I mean, she did
mornings.
She
did mornings. Yeah, she went over to Fox. Did mornings. She was in New York City for a while.
She went over to Fox 61.
Yeah, she was launched the morning show that
5 million hour.
Yeah,
jeez.
But she was commuting. We lived in Bloomfield at the time. She was commuting from Bloomfield to New York City, working at CBS.
Oh, she went to network for a little bit.
She would leave 1 o'clock in the morning to get there by 3.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Work until 11.
She worked on their morning show.
Yeah.
Oh wow, she probably knows John Tower, a guy I worked with at MSNBC. Anyway, I want to get into a whole bunch of different things. Obviously, you do some lobbying at the state capitol. How was Christmas? You got two kids. Are they still true believers?
Christmas was great. Santa was great to them, as he always is. And it was great. You know, it's just like, do we ever go back to school or is this it? This is just now our life.
Well, we were just talking, like, I have teenagers. They barely say hello to me in the morning. And so, like, I have plenty of time to myself. But when your kids are 10 and 4 or whatever, like, when you're home, you're the guy.
It's go time.
You're on all the time.
And it's a lot of fun, right? Because we're about to head into session when I'm not really home.
Right.
And so dad time is, you know, minimal and there needs to be more of that. And I try to find the balance between being home and being at work or not working when I'm at home or whatever it might be. So these, like, 2 weeks are great. But kids thrive in routine. And it's, you know.
It's starting to come apart.
It's, you know, Vietnam circa 1968 right now. Like, it is. You know, you just keep your head down. You try to keep everything moving forward. But no, it's been a lot of fun.
So what do? Do you have to program every day, or like are you just sort of winging it? I mean, are you coming up with activities? Like I'm so far gone from that. You got two kids, and they're fully non-scheduled.
They're fully.
Are they
non-scheduled?
Doing play dates and
we
stuff?
We do some play dates a little bit, but a lot of people travel. You know, I have almost a 10-year-old. His birthday's in a few weeks, and then a 4.5-year-old. So like we're on. You know, but we've gone sledding and, you know, you go do this thing or that thing or you go to the bookstore or whatever it might be. You just kind of keep moving. You can't sit around and be on screens
all day.
Yeah,
they don't nap either. So
No, we did take a nice nap yesterday. When's the last time you took a nap?
I do this shift. I try to take a nap every day.
Yeah.
But I mean, in your life, I would see it as a luxury, but I don't. To me, it's like it's not a privilege. It's a right, the way I live my life. But I wanted to – there's one topic I want to get into, and we'll talk about the session. We'll talk about the race for governor. We have a bunch of things to discuss related to the state. It's kind of amazing to me, this discussion about energy prices, which I want to get into as well. But one thing Matt and I have talked a lot about, and you're an Ohio State fan, college football to me and college basketball are so messed up. This whole Baylor, like – guy coming from the pros,
right? Yeah,
to play there. Just it seems to be maybe an inflection point. But as someone who supports a team that won the national championship last year, famously spent $20 million on a payroll for players,
mm-hmm.
and then I'm just curious if you like it any less because of the mercenary aspect of what's going on.
I don't. I think that what was happening in the shadows is now just happening in front of us. Players, I don't think, were getting paid cash the way that they are now, for sure. But there were all sorts of perks and things. If you were the best player in the country and you played for Ohio State or Alabama or whatever, like
they found a
way to make it worth your time. Players had to get paid. This is, I mean, the world of college sports, especially basketball and football, is a massive multi-billion-dollar conglomeration. They're corporations. that are making tons and tons and tons of money.
But it's like the gold rush in the 1840s. I mean, there's no regulation. There's no oversight. I mean, personally, I'm the opposite. I think it's awful. I believe they do deserve compensation, but I think because the NCAA is powerless and everyone's so afraid of getting sued, no one will impose any order to it.
Well, two things can be true at the same time, right? One, it can be good that they're getting paid, and two, there needs to be some regulation around it, right? I saw Hurley's comments about needing a commissioner for basketball or for, you know, whatever it might be because of this.
Or maybe a salary cap. Back.
You could do a salary cap. You could, but the problem is that a lot of these kids aren't getting paid in cash. They're getting paid in endorsement deals, or there's cash that goes into a fund that then gets delivered, you know, paid out across the whole team, so that the third string guy isn't getting $0 while the top guy's making, you know, $5 million or whatever it might be. So
maybe that's happening at Ohio State, but there are individuals getting seven figures at a ton of institutions, and they're getting it direct paid to themselves.
Yeah, but sure. But also, you know, you can't say the product is bad. The product is the Georgia Ole Miss game last night was unbelievable.
Correct.
You know, the Ohio State Miami game wasn't,
not so much.
Wasn't as great, in my opinion, but I'm sure that if you're a Miami fan, you certainly thought it was good. I think the playoff is good overall. I don't know that it gets us the best team in the country, but does the NCAA basketball tournament get us the best team in the country? No, this is what people want to watch, right? People want to see Miami beat Ohio State. People want to see Indiana. Indiana hasn't been in a national championship discussion since the 60s, I think.
Yeah.
Hasn't been in the Rose Bowl since. I mean, that's exciting stuff. That's good for college sports.
I think it's bad for Ohio State.
Yeah, of course it is. And we can talk about why we want to change it back to the way that it was.
Well, no, because I think that this, we were talking this morning, you know, my take, I think Lane Kiffin going to LSU, I thought it was just so old school.
Well, Brian, Lane Kiffin is a bad person.
No, I understand that, but that's part of the discussion. But like, not only could he have stayed at Ole Miss and become a legend, but the point is like you can become every bit as viable a winner at Ole Miss than you can at LSU. Like the legacy school doesn't have nearly the advantages that it did even 5 or 10 years ago. Because look at Indiana, you get some money and the right coach.
Well, that's what I was gonna say.
2 years, it's a different ballgame.
If you were starting Shaq Minyu and you could pick between Kurt Cernetti, who's the head coach at Indiana, or Lane Kiffin, who's now at LSU, who were you going to want?
I'd want the Indiana guy.
Of course you would. So, the legacy school thing still matters, of course, and it matters for recruiting, and let's hope that UConn—
Does it, though?
It does, because UConn now can't compete at the level of the Ohio State, Indiana, you know, Oklahoma, Georgia, the big schools, because they can't recruit, because they don't have the flash on a national scale. So does UConn football now find a way into a conference, or does UConn football find a way to pay the players more? And then are you getting players who are really interested in trying to compete for a championship or just want to make money and then try to play on Sunday? So, you know, the legacy schools still matter, but I don't think they matter in such a small scale as they do, as they used to. Now with Cernetti at Indiana, you know, Tulane got into the playoff. You know, they didn't compete. James Madison got into the playoff. So now if you're a 2.5-3-star recruit out of high school, you don't have to look at going to sit on the bench at Ohio State for 2 years. You go play at JMU and potentially play in the college football playoff.
Yeah, I mean, this is a whole conversation. We're not going to do a full sports show today. I have tons of opinions on this because I think about it all the time and I talk about it all the time. But we're here with Chris Vandio from Penn League and Strategies. I wanted to talk about the governor's race. And don't give me this political garbage, okay?
You don't want a political answer about the governor's race?
No, because you're not working for, I know where you stand politically in party affiliation, but you're not working for a party or a candidate.
That's right.
Okay, so the first question is, who comes out of the Republican side, Fazio or Stewart? They're both good candidates, and I really could see blah, 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 blah.
I
like them both.
I'm going to give you a straight up answer.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Ugh, that's even worse.
Because I don't know enough about the Republican
makeup
of the convention.
You're afraid to go on record? You're afraid to go on record.
I will go on record about who's going to win the Democratic primary.
Okay.
Happy to do that.
I think Governor Lamont
probably wins that one pretty well. Aaron Stewart and Ryan Fazio are two of the most exciting candidates that either party has had for quite some time. They're the first candidates we've had who are in their 50s and 60s and 70s. They are relatively moderate players in their side of the aisle, and they're super smart. And I think that this is really exciting for the Republican Party. And if I'm talking to my friends in the Democratic Party, I'm saying, hey, we have to focus on this a little bit.
Well, it's about 2030 for them.
Correct.
You know, obviously, I think that it's executive versus legislative. Like, you have a woman who's led a city. You have a young man who's done a good job in a non-executive capacity. So she's used to running the meetings. He's used to being a positive participant in the meetings, if you will. And I think that makes a difference. I think, first of all, he's great looking and he's smart and he seems to be a good person.
Yeah.
So he has that. He gets in a room. He doesn't command the space quite the same way she does. She can be her. I think her effort to be folksy and a real person sometimes leads her in a way where she talks, puts things in a framework that maybe is not the way she should.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I've known Erin for, I don't know, 15 years probably, and you never have to ask her what she's thinking. You never wonder where she stands on something, and I think that is, people find that, you know, new, right? She doesn't beat around the bush. She's great. Ryan is more cerebral, I think, and plays more of the role of the legislative bomb thrower, but does it in a relatively diplomatic way. And there's a lot of benefit to that as well. So I think that this is really exciting for for both of them, frankly, and for the Republican Party in Connecticut that has, again, frankly, for the last 4 years, 6 years, trying to find its way.
So, but neither you think have a chance in the general?
I just don't right now. I guess my question for you is, do they find a way to get together? Right? Is this a Stuart Fazio?
But who would take the beta? Who would take the beta chair? That's my thing. Is like, people have said that to me. I have listeners who say that. Well, if they combine forces, they'd have a real chance, and I think that might be true. But I wouldn't want to ask one to be the lieutenant governor. Right? I mean, they're both super young, and if you take that lieutenant governor spot, you could be 4, could be 8 years, could be 12 years before you could get. Other spot, because if you take the lieutenant governor spot and lose, then you got 4 more years of that. But the other person's ahead of you already because they were the gubernatorial candidate. Say the gubernatorial candidate wins in 2030, then wins in 2034, then you get a Bicewitz dynamic where the window might end up closing.
Sure, but if one of them or they don't get together, if none of them win, and Ned Lamont gets another 4 years. How do Erin Stewart, who's no longer the mayor of New Britain, and Ryan Fazio, presumably no longer in the state senate, stay in front of
people,
yeah. Right? And we've seen it with Luke Bronin. It's tough, right? It's tough. Really talented players in politics don't get the next rung and have nowhere else to sit, and the game musical chairs just keeps going on, and you're not sitting down.
I mean, I've posed that same question to Republicans. They seem to express less concern that those two, one of two or both, could stay in the media, but I think you're 100% correct. I mean, if you're not currently in a position, what are you going to do to get attention? I think it's an interesting thing. I just can't see them, one of them acquiescing. I just don't see it.
But if you come out of the convention and one of them wins massively,
decisively,
and the other can still qualify for a primary, do you take it to a primary or do you say to each other, hey, let's put this thing to bed and go try to beat Ned Lamont?
Yeah. I've said it on the show. I was not hoping for his, it's no personal thing. I was hoping he didn't run for a third term because I don't want to wait 4 years for an open race.
Yeah.
And I think an open race would have been fascinating, whoever it was. I mean, Bronin wouldn't run in the first district. He'd run for governor. And then you have Tong, you have Scanlon, you have Bicewitz. Who else is in there?
I think that's probably pretty much it. I mean, an open governor's race is just fun.
Yeah, but with these candidates,
especially
like, I've had Scanlon on a lot. He's a nice guy. I like him. And Tong has been on the show many times too. I would consider those two the front runners. I think that Bicewitz.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Even though she's in front of a lot of people a lot of time, I don't think she's as dynamic. And against either Fazio or Stewart is a phenomenal race to cover.
I couldn't agree more. And there are other Democrats out there who probably would come out of the woodwork, who would just say, why not? And maybe not see it to the end of the night. But
just hope to get lightning in a bottle.
Right. You never know.
I don't want to wait 4 more years. I'm going to be old. I'm already old. Chris Vandehoof.
You look good. The Gavin Newsom of the East.
Oh, that's nice. I like that. I actually don't like that, but I like that because I think
purely looks.
Listen, he is a handsome man in my opinion, and he's got good hair. Chris Vandehoof from Penn Lincoln Strategies joining us here on Brian and Company. I also want to talk a little bit about before we get specifically to the legislative session. What are, like, for you, when you look at the landscape, the big issues for Connecticut in 2026? I know it's a broad question.
Yeah. No, it's the first one that we're trying to figure out, folks in my world, is what are we doing with a budget? Or, you know, we're going to make this as short as possible, go into a short session in Connecticut. Even years are short sessions. They run from the beginning of February to the beginning of May.
Right.
We have a biannual budget in our state, and in the short sessions are generally supposed to be about budget adjustments to keep the budget in balance. But our budget is in balance, and we have a massive surplus, and we have a massive rainy day fund. And while the cuts are certainly a part of what's happening in Washington, D.C. for the state of Connecticut, we may not have to adjust all that much. And so if we don't do a budget adjustment, we didn't do one 2 years ago, and if we don't do one this time, then what are we going to do? I think the legislature really is trying to figure out how to grapple with energy prices.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the legislature is really trying to figure out how to grapple with regulation around energy prices and regulation with the utility companies and the utility generators and in the water space. And so I think there's a lot happening there that could just dominate the entire session.
So energy is one thing. I'm curious if you think that more of the surplus or rainy day fund needs to be either put aside or allocated to offset what doesn't come from the federal government.
Yeah,
I know they put aside the $500 million.
Yeah, and you know the snap world is an ever changing thing, and I don't pretend to know a lot about how it all comes together. I know that the folks over at FoodShare are working with the state on this, and the governor's office, and the bipartisanness of that to make that work is great. I think that what folks are trying to figure out is. And I know your listeners would love this. Do we find a way in an election year to reduce some tax exposure for the citizens of the state of Connecticut? What do we do about the property tax situation, the car tax situation?
You think Lamont will come in on those things? I mean, he's already done some giveaways.
He's done some giveaways.
Some vote buying, not buying, but some vote-focused giveaways,
sure.
If you will. But I mean, I think it makes sense. I've asked Democrats even Democrats say that, you know, maybe we should look at, you know, a tax cut of some sort.
Yeah, I think that the Connecticut, I mean, the income tax is never going back to what it was. And it's a relatively, in comparison to the federal tax setup, it's relatively easy to do. I think where things get a little tricky is the local property taxes, the local car taxes, and those kind of taxes that really hit folks on top of all the other stuff that's happening. But the towns need that revenue. How does the state continue to deal with this, right? Having 169 autonomous towns.
Yeah.
Turns out is a difficult way to manage a state of 3.5 million people.
I mean, the easy way to do it is just somehow find a way to just subsidize the towns more, but then that becomes an expectation year in and year out, and people forget the reasons.
Well, and every town's different, right? The city of Hartford, 60% of the town's non-taxable property.
Right.
So, you know, what do you do there versus, you know, Glastonbury where 85% of the town is taxable property?
Fair point. As a lobbyist, like,
can I interrupt you real quick?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. We were talking about Bruno Mars and
oh, you had
Bad
an opinion.
Bunny. I have an opinion on this because I took the New York, I think it was New York Times, could have been CNN, can you name these 25 faces from 2025?
And you couldn't pick up?
Bad Bunny wasn't on there.
Okay.
And I got like 18 of the 25 right. Number one was Taylor Swift.
Right.
98% of people recognized
her. Right. Okay.
Number two was the Pope. At 92%.
I'm a huge fan of the Pope, by the way.
Yeah, sure, the Pope's great, but how about more people recognize Taylor Swift than
the Pope?
They do
yeah, Pope that's is. But the ship has already sailed for me. Like, I mean, I think that I don't know, for the last 10 years I feel like that not just her, but like celebrity has usurped the substantive world for a long time.
Yeah, because people, content creation, they follow what they're interested
and
in.
Now
they're not interested in the Pope.
And the story of late 2025 and 2026 for me is it gets even more difficult to separate, you know, what's real and what's fake. You know, because I mean, we just talked about Instagram where you have this love-hate thing with it and you go on it, you're off it. And my thing is that you've consumed so many videos. I mean, how many videos do you see for the 10th, 11th, 12th time? Because there's not enough content out there. So that's where AI comes in and creates all this fake content to feed the beast, because people want to keep scrolling down and seeing new things. You know, talk about new things. Like, you in an off year session, what do you have to do? Like, if nobody knows what's going to happen, so like people who you advocate for, they might not be able to have any chance. Like in a regular budget year, everything's open, right? Yeah. I mean, you can get things introduced, discussed, you know, but in the off year, what is there to do?
Yeah, I mean, the general rule of thumb is that if you're going to introduce something new, it takes about 3 sessions to get it passed.
So you'll do some legwork in this session.
So you
for
do
whatever.
A lot of legwork in a short session. You start to introduce things that clients might have that are interesting ideas, you know, new investment opportunities. Maybe a company wants to move here or wants to rearrange something, or, you know, there's a new policy idea that's bubbling up in other states that it's time to start walking that out in Connecticut and see where that goes. You know, there's some stuff that didn't make it through last year that you want to maybe take another shot at, or stuff that did make it through, but in the throes of the final hours of session kind of technically got, you know, a little out of order. And so you got to clean those up. And so it's an opportunity that, you know, short sessions are a sprint. You know, the long session feels like it takes forever because it takes almost 6 months. You know, this is done in 2.5 months. And so the hearings start, you know, in the end of February. Committees finish their work at the end of March, beginning of April, and before you know it, you're full on session for a month.
So, you know, you have a natural circulation of clients, right? Some are just there for a year or 2 years or whatever, and then their business is done or whatever, they move on. I don't know what causes them to come or go, and there's a natural order of things. Is also maybe they didn't get what they wanted or whatever. What's the turnover like for you in terms of clients?
Well, we like to keep our clients for as long as we can, obviously.
But there's a natural churn.
For sure, right? And some, you know, we've had some foundational clients that have been with us since day one, and I suspect will be with us forever, and they have evergreen issues, or, you know, their issues aren't Senate Bill 123, their issues are education, their issues are environment, right? And so, like, they're with you all the time, but then bills pop up, or clients hire you for the session, and you kill it, or you try to pass it, or you negotiate, or whatever you have to do, and then sometimes they're done at the, you know, halfway through the year, and then they come back the next session. That happens too.
So does a party come in and say, okay, we want to do this, and they'll solicit a bunch of lobby firms for sure. Bids?
For sure. Yeah, that happens all the time. Yeah. And then you got to go in, you interview, and you know the other 2 or 3 firms, and you text those guys and how'd your interview go? And, you know, it's
do you get nervous about new business, like growing the business? I mean, because I feel like...
Yeah, of course. You're always nervous when you're running a small business, right? You know, you lose 2 clients and now you have to go plug the hole. You get 3 new clients at the end of the year and now you're going to the following year and you say, all right, how do I get 2 more clients on top of that without losing any clients? And then you may lose a couple clients and now you have to get 4 more. Then every January 1, it all restarts, right? The vast majority of clients have annual contracts. And so basically Thanksgiving to the end of the year, you spend all your time trying to make sure they're all coming back in the door.
How's business?
Business is great. Couldn't be more excited.
Some people listen and say business is great. They think that's not good, right? They're like, if the lobby business is great, then maybe that's not so good.
Listen, in today's world, being a lobbyist is a good job to have, for sure, right? Navigating the political, governmental logistics is complicated and difficult. And I've always said that the best lobbyists are the ones that understand the logistics and the rules of how government operates. It isn't necessarily has the best relationships with so-and-so.
Well, at least I feel like at the state level, and again, I'm saying this with mostly ignorance, but it feels like at least the lobby does as much lobbying for things to get done as opposed to lobbying for things not to get done. Whereas I think DC lobbying is almost always lobbying to not get things done, right? Yeah. They're trying to make sure something does not happen. And I think that there's a difference.
Yeah, well, I mean, what we've seen nationally over the last, I don't know, say decade or so, is that major corporations used to spend tens of millions of dollars in Washington, D.C. on lobbying. And they're taking those budget dollars out of D.C. and putting them in states. Because state legislatures, by and large across the country, whether Republicans or Democrats, red or blue, do more.
Yeah, they don't legislate in D.C. They just do government opening or closing and a defense budget. I mean, that's like, what else do they do?
No, right. So if you're a multinational corporation and you have to lobby in D.C. because of the way your business is set up, but you're not passing policy down there. Yeah. You're passing policy in Hartford or in Albany or in Sacramento.
So state-level stuff has gotten more important.
I don't know the answer to this, but I would bet that the dollars put into state lobbying nationally is up exponentially from where it was a decade ago.
He's Chris Vandyhoof. He's from Penn Lincoln Strategies.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.